Deutschlandfunk Nova. Eine Stunde Film. Mit Tom Westerholt.
Ja, Rollgras weht durchs Studio. Einsam und verlassen ziehe ich Runde um Runde auf meinem alten, gebrechlichen Klepper durch die elendweite Prärie unseres Büros. Schon wieder alleine, denke ich, während Jolly Jumper unter mir müde in den Staub schnaubt. Es ist keine Anna Wollner hier, ausgenockt von irgendwelchen Influencern. Wobei ich glaube, es ist eher die, also Einzahl und mit A am Ende, Influenz A. Grippe, Frau Wollner liegt brach, ihr müsst mit mir auskommen für heute. Ich habe mir aber einigermaßen Mühe gegeben, euch trotzdem was Nettes zusammenzubrutzeln in meiner Speck- und Bohnenpfanne, die hier hinten an meinem durchgerittenen Sattel baumelt. Ein bisschen nerdy wird's vielleicht heute. Ich hoffe, ihr kommt damit klar. Wir haben unter anderem die großartige Filmmusikkomponistin Rachel Portman zu Gast.
You know, in terms of me being the first woman, you know, it was, to me, that was irrelevant. All I was interested in was doing my best as a composer in film.
Und wir begrüßen Hollywood-Produzent Jeremy Latcham. Das ist der Mann für die ersten Filme von dann legendären Franchises.
First movies are really special. You know, you come to it and it's, anything's possible. And the further along you go, the more windows and doors close. You know, things become less possible once things start becoming real.
Der erste Iron Man ist von ihm, genau wie der erste Avengers-Film oder der erste Guardians of the Galaxy. Und aktuell natürlich Dungeons and Dragons, Ehre unter Dieben. Deswegen haben wir uns in Berlin getroffen. Wir starten aber mit etwas, auf das sich viele von euch genauso gefreut haben, wie ich mich, das weiß ich, nämlich auf den dritten Film ihrer langjährigen Zusammenarbeit, bei dem Ben Affleck und Matt Damon sowohl das Drehbuch geschrieben haben, als auch gemeinsam vor der Kamera stehen. Er, der große Wurf. Kleines Novum gibt's sogar noch obendrauf. Es ist der erste Film, bei dem einer der beiden Best Buddies dann auch noch Regie geführt hat, Ben Affleck. Der spielt hier den Nike-Gründer Phil Knight und muss sich als solcher irgendwann 1984 von seinem Markenchef Sonny Vaccaro, gespielt von Matt Damon, eine ziemlich abenteuerliche Marketing-Idee anhören.
Ich verwette hiermit meine Karriere auf Michael Jordan.
Ach komm schon, Mann.
Du hast mich gefragt, was ich hier mache. Das mache ich. Ich suche Spieler für dich. Und diesmal habe ich das richtige Gefühl. Ja gut, es ist riskant. Es war auch riskant, als du Sneaker aus dem Kofferraum deines Plymouths verkauft hast. Es brauchte Mut. Wenn du ihn dir mal ansiehst, wenn du dir Jordan genau ansiehst, so wie ich, dann siehst du genau das, was ich sehe.
Und zwar?
Den Spieler mit der größten Leistungsbereitschaft und Fähigkeit aller Zeiten.
Sonny Vaccaro hat in den 80ern für Nike vor allem den Highschool-Basketball in den USA beobachtet und danach kommenden Talenten so rumgescoutet. Denn anders als heute vielleicht viele vermuten, war Nike in den 80ern überhaupt gar kein Big Fish in Sachen Basketball. Da gab es Converse und vor allem, wissen viele auch nicht, die deutsche Firma Adidas, die die großen Stars der Liga ausgestattet haben. Nikes waren Laufschuhe, die trug man zum Joggen, aber mit Sicherheit nicht zum Basketballspielen. Also so ein paar Spiele hatten die zwar da unter Vertrag, aber jetzt nichts Dolles. Und jetzt will dieser Sonny Vaccaro allen Ernstes sämtlichen Marketing-Etat von deren klitzekleiner Basketballabteilung in diesen einen 18-jährigen Newcomer Michael Jordan stecken. Phil macht sich große Sorgen und Sonny sich einfach auf den Weg.
Hey, wo zum Teufel steckst du?
North Carolina!
Gott verdammt, Sonny, wie wär's mit einem Anruf?
Ich ruf dich doch gerade an, ich sitze im Auto, der Mietwagen hat ein Telefon.
Ja, nicht bei mir, bei den Eltern.
Es wäre unprofessionell von mir, sie nur anzurufen.
Klar, deshalb tauchst du lieber gleich vor ihrer Tür auf.
Hör mal, falls jemand fragen sollte, wo ich bin, sag einfach, ich bin krank.
Du sagst es, geisteskrank.
Denn, und das war damals der nächste Klopper, es war ein wirklich ungeschriebenes Gesetz, dass man sich als Sportartikelhersteller nicht direkt an die SportlerInnen ranwanzt. Das ging alles über deren Agenten und der Agent von Michael Jordan damals war David Falk. Und der wiederum, ja, war so Typ cholerischer, wüterig, oberstes Regal. Die Kacke hat also richtig gedampft, als Sonny Vaccaro damals diesen totalen Alleingang gestartet hat. Mehr zur Story an dieser Stelle nicht, sonst verrate ich schon zu viel von dieser wirklich packenden amerikanischen Wirtschafts- und natürlich auch Sportgeschichte, die so voller Wows ist. Nur vielleicht als wichtige Randnotiz noch, nicht nur Ben Affleck und Matt Damon spielen hier wirklich großartig, sowohl miteinander als auch in ihren jeweiligen Einzelszenen, die sie nicht miteinander haben. Also denen merkt man wirklich in jeder Filmsekunde an, wie gerne die miteinander arbeiten, eben weil sie halt seit 40 plus Jahren seit ihrer Kindheit Best Buddies sind. Aber nicht nur die beiden sind hier so toll. Allen voran Viola Davis als Michael Jordans Mutter und Managerin Dolores Jordan ist zum Niederknien. Sie war übrigens Michael Jordans Hauptbedingung, diesem Film überhaupt zuzustimmen. Also nur, wenn Viola Davis seine Mutter spielt, war die Bedingung von Michael Jordan. Und sie macht es, her mit dem Oscar, ne? So macht sie's. Dazu Jason Bateman, ebenfalls aus dem Nike-Team in einer sehr coolen Rolle, genau wie ein großartiger Chris Tucker als Nike-Vizepräsident Howard White. Dieser Howard White muss ein totales Unikum gewesen sein und sämtliche Menschen, die Howard White kannten, haben schon attestiert, dass Chris Tucker den wirklich auf den Kopf trifft in seiner Darstellung. Oder auch zwei sehr lustige Nebenrollen, Gustav Skarsgård und Barbara Sukowa als deutsche Adidas-Erben. Also auch deren Firmenstory hat in Ansätzen zumindest noch Platz. Und trotzdem hatte ich nie das Gefühl, in diesem Film überladen zu werden. Also die wichtigsten Wirtschaftsinfos, die werden hier so gesteckt, dass wir die gut verdauen können. Den größten Platz lassen Affleck und Damon in Sachen Buch und Regie, aber dem Zusammenspiel der einzelnen Figuren. Und das ist hier wirklich wie Blitzschach, jeder gegen jeden. Brillante Dialoge. Affleck ist zudem mittlerweile ein richtig guter Regisseur. Und dann fallen denen auch noch so Kniffe ein, Michael Jordan einfach im ganzen Film nicht einmal von vorne zu zeigen. Denn natürlich wird der mittlerweile frisch 60-jährige Goat hier von einem viel jüngeren Darsteller gespielt. Es wäre komisch gewesen, wenn Michael Jordan da plötzlich selber als 18-Jähriger durchs Bild latscht. Aber die beiden Filmemacher sagen, Michael Jordan ist eine so große Legende, wenn man da jetzt ein anderes Gesicht im Film zeigen würde, dann würde jeder sagen, sorry, aber das da ist mit Sicherheit nicht Michael Jordan. Also haben sie sich dazu entschieden, ihn im Film einfach gesichtslos zu lassen, ihn immer nur im Anschnitt zu zeigen oder komplett von hinten oder teilweise auch einfach nur, wenn er aus dem Auto steigt, dann sieht man so diese riesigen Füße. Also tolle Ideen gehabt, um auch das in den Film einzubetten. Wenn ihr euch unterm Strich jetzt einen Scheiß für Basketball interessiert, noch dazu einen Scheiß für Michael Jordan und euch amerikanische Wirtschaftsgeschichte auch null interessiert, wenn ihr Matt Damon doof und Ben Affleck überbewertet findet und über Viola Davis sagt, ja, auch schon bessere gesehen, dann könnt ihr sicherlich aus diesem Film draußen bleiben. Allerdings dann, genauso ehrlich gesagt, auch aus diesem Podcast, dann hört euch bitte irgendwas anderes an. Aber sollte nur eins davon euch wirklich interessieren, dann würde das schon völlig ausreichen, um euch ab Donnerstag diesen Film anzuschauen. Air, so heißt er, logischerweise wie Air Jordan, die Linie, die genau diesen Basketballschuh Air Jordan aktuell in Version 35 führt. Version 35, seit dem legendären Air Jordan 1, damals den ich zur Feier des Tages hier heute übrigens anhabe. So, ich kriege da nichts für, das ist reine Ehrerbietung. Ich habe in den Schuhen, also jetzt nicht in diesem Paar hier, was ich gerade anhabe, sondern in diesem Modell, in Air Jordans, mein Basketball-Abi damals gemacht. Legenden, die man sich an die Füße ziehen kann. Geht ab Donnerstag in den Film und kriegt bitte genauso Lust wie ich, euch dann einfach auch gleich nochmal die Netflix-Doku The Last Dance anzugucken. Diese letzte legendäre NBA-Saison von Michael Jordans Chicago Bulls 1997. Und wenn mich jetzt keiner stoppt, rede ich vermutlich endlos weiter. Wo ist eigentlich eine Anna Wollner, wenn man sie wirklich mal dringend braucht? Alle Daumen hoch, alle, die ich habe. Absolut der Kinofilm der Woche, großartige Matt Damon, Ben Affleck Reunion, liebe diesen Film sehr, Nicht zuletzt, und das ist dann möglicherweise mein Schlusswort, auch wegen des überragenden 80er-Jahre-Soundtracks. Der ganze Film geht gleich los mit Money for Nothing von Dire Straits und diesem Mega-Synthi-Drums-Gitarren-Intro. Dann sind da so Songs drin wie My Adidas von Run DMC, natürlich. Sister Christian, Time After Time, Born in the USA. Und jeder Song, das ist hier das Geniale, jeder Song nailt die jeweilige Szene zu 100%. Was in irgend so einem Manta-Film, der jetzt auch gerade im Kino ist, vor die Wand gefahren wurde, machen die zwei hier also auch noch mit großer Genialität. So, jetzt schnell auf den Knopf drücken hier, bevor mir noch irgendwas einfällt, was ich sagen könnte.
Deutschlandfunk Nova. Eine Stunde Film.
Denn dann würde ich euch jetzt wirklich gerne mit einer Frau bekannt machen, die Filmmusiken geschrieben hat für Filme wie Chocolat, Das Haus am See, Der Manchurien-Kandidat, Zwei an einem Tag, Für immer Liebe, Gottes Werk und Teufels Beitrag oder natürlich auch Emma mit Gwyneth Paltrow und Ewan McGregor, für den sie als Filmmusikkomponistin 1997 einen Oscar gekriegt hat. Nicht irgendeinen Oscar, sondern den ersten überhaupt als Frau, die nicht Mitglied eines Filmmusikteams gewesen ist, sondern halt eben als Solokomponistin. Die Liste ihrer Scores ist sehr lang. Es sind über 100 Filme, Serien, Dokus, die da insgesamt zusammenkommen. Und jetzt hat sie eine neue CD draußen, auf der sie erstmals ihre berühmtesten Filmmusiken selbst am Piano eingespielt hat. Neu von ihr arrangiert, und zwar so, das finde ich sehr spannend, so wie sie sie ursprünglich auch am Klavier für diese Filme komponiert hat, bevor dann diese, das kennt ihr, diese Bombast-Arrangements draus werden mit Pauken, Trompeten und gefühlt einer Million von Streichern. Wir haben uns über Zoom getroffen, ich in meinem Kabuff, sie in ihrem geschätzt 100 Quadratmeter Dachgeschoss-Loft in ihrer Heimat England. Da habe ich nur kurz gedacht, als ich sie da habe sitzen sehen, also da würde ich auch gern kreativ sein, aber gut, meine 4 Quadratmeter Aufnahme, Abstellraum, Besenkammer haben natürlich auch was, ganz klar. Wissen müsst ihr für das Gespräch, dass der Film Gottes Werk und Teufels Beitrag im Original The Cider House Rules heißt, sonst versteht ihr eine wichtige Passage unseres Gesprächs gleich nicht. Angefangen haben wir aber mit der Frage, was macht eine Filmmusikkomponistin eigentlich, wenn sie Musik schreiben muss, der Film aber noch gar nicht fertig gedreht ist? Das passiert nämlich relativ häufig. Versucht man dann, so viel wie möglich über die Story und den Look des Films dem Regisseur, der Regisseurin irgendwie aus der Nase zu ziehen?
Yeah, you find out as much as you can from the directors, and but often those things change. It's really interesting to see how they change, you know. For example, when I worked with Jonathan Demme on, I worked with him on 3 films, but on Beloved and The Truth About Charlie and The Manchurian Candidate. And he got me involved really early, and it had mixed results. Sometimes it was really great, and that music flew into the film and it just stayed in there all the way along, especially in Beloved. But then in The Truth About Charlie, I wrote quite a lot of music that he got very excited about, and then it didn't have a place in the film. A bit like, you know, how they sometimes cut actors' parts.
Yeah.
You know, or character can be cut out, that kind of thing. You think it's really important at the time, and then for whatever reason, you think, oh, actually the story's going to work better without it. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit like that.
Okay. So you then put it in the cupboard and pull it out next time?
Well, the very sad thing is you try, you think, yeah, I'll put it away, but it doesn't ever get used again. Mm. But my feeling is that no, this is my philosophy about writing music, because nothing is ever wasted. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is it goes back into, it's like a soup. If you think of it like a sort of soup that has been, you've been cooking this soup for most of your life.
Yeah.
And it's an ingredient that just goes back into the pot, and it'll come out at some point, or you will have learned something.
Yeah. There are these 20 beautiful tracks on this CD that I'm having right here, and Sony allowed us to take a bit of your music and play it in the podcast. So what I would like to do is to ask you to pick one in particular
that we can play for maybe some seconds, and you could use it to describe how you came up with it, what kind of a meaning it had at the time, to just understand the process of score writing a little bit better.
Yeah, okay. So I guess I'll choose, I'll choose the Side House Rules. Probably just because that's one of the ones that's best known.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with, this was a score that was difficult, and I spent a long time on it. And I wrote a whole score for it. And then after I was all finished, the director came back and said, you know what, I think it's missing a theme. I think we need more material in there. I really like what you've done, but I think there's something missing in terms of we need another theme. And so I was like, oh my goodness, what am I going to go and do? So I went back to the drawing board and I was thinking, you know, what shall I write? And then there was a little phrase in one piece that I'd done, and Lassie said to me, I like that little phrase that you did there. And I was like, right. I know what to do. So I made that phrase into that is the opening bars of this piece of music. And what this music is doing, it's threading together the whole story of this really, really wonderful film and book by John Irving, which is about, it's about an orphanage. It's about growing up. It's about love. And it's a mixture between happy and sad. So it's not just sad. Mm-hmm. It's not just happy either. It's somewhere, it sort of goes along that line in the middle. And I wanted to write a thread of a melody that I could, you know, build throughout the film, so that by the end, it's a really strong character in the film.
Then came 1996 and Emma, a story that we all know, of course, where you at the Oscars became the first female solo composer winning an Oscar ever.
Yeah.
What changed through that?
Well, it opened doors for me. I was young and it definitely opened doors for me. I was doing well already. But what it did was it gave me a seal of approval,
mm-hmm.
you know, that the industry, a big, big seal of approval, which I could never have imagined, you know, would happen. So, in terms of me being the first woman, you know, it was, to me, that was irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
All I was interested in was, you know, doing my best as a composer in film.
Yeah.
I never paid it any attention.
Mm. I'm asking for a particular reason, because if you get nominated for best score in Hollywood, you normally get nominated alongside men like Alan Menken, Hans Zimmer, of course, John Williams, and one of the thousand Newmans that are out there and who are related somehow to each other, all of them. Alexandre Desplat, maybe, to mention another one, but you can see where I'm heading to. Question is, where are the women since 1996? There haven't been so many.
No, there haven't. I don't know. I think it's regrettable how long it's taking for things to change, because you know, it's a perception that. It's a man's job, and that's why there aren't. You know, it is changing, and it's changing slowly, but not. But to for me, it's changing too slowly.
Yeah.
But there are many female film composers out there now.
Yeah.
And you know, they need to get the big breaks, and the film industry would benefit hugely from their music. Because their voices, their musical voices, are a really important addition.
If you look back for the past 10 years, which I did, there was Hildur Gundadottir from Iceland.
Yeah.
And
he's fantastic, yeah.
And there is, if I didn't miscount, there was one other woman in the past 10 years even nominated. So
yeah.
Two female composers over 10 Terrible. Years. Is that still because the female composers that are there just don't get the jobs? Or is it maybe because, that's what I also heard, that if you take Steven Spielberg, for example, he only wants John Williams because he's his composer for the past 30 or 40 years. So is being a film composer something that is, that connects you to only a few filmmakers that book you again and again and again?
Yeah, I mean, it can be. You can have a relationship with a director where they just want you always to score everything that they do. And a lot of directors do that. They feel very comfortable with one person. And then there are other directors who want to have a different kind of sensibility, even though, of course, film composers can have very different sensibilities depending on, you know, what, you know, we can write in many, many different ways. It's a strange thing. I think women aren't given the jobs. I think there is a perception that, oh, we'll give it to the guys, you know, because this is an important big film and, you know, I should probably play it safe and, you know. I'm guessing, I don't know, but I think, you know, and, it, you know, if it's a documentary, yeah, maybe, you know, well, it's fine that you'll see women composers far more frequently in film documentaries, really good documentaries and stuff, but that feels safe, that women have broken through there. But it's taking its time with you know, sort of major pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe as a last question for today, with your really impressive filmography, what story would you still like to tell with your music that you haven't been telling during the past 40 years?
Oh, well, I have to answer that. That's a story about the environment and about listening to the world around us and the earth and nature. And I do that in my non-film work all the time because I do quite a lot of concert work as well. And that is the urgent burning musical question for me. And that's where I feel I can, you know, as well as I'm doing TV series at the moment. And, you know, but as well, I balance the two side by side. But that's where I feel my work is most important when I'm not working in film and TV.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well,
okay.
Then I would be very curious to hear something like that from you in the future.
You definitely will.
Okay. Thank you for the talk in Eine Stunde Film, Rachel Portman. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, it was really good to talk to you.
Hört vielleicht einfach mal rein in Beyond the Screen. Das ist das Album von Rachel Portman. Gibt's auch bei vielen Streamern. Wirklich ganz viel bekannte Filmmusik drauf. Von einer ganz tollen Komponistin, die nebenbei, kann man sich denken, auch noch wirklich hervorragend Klavier spielen kann. Von der Filmmusik weiter zur Filmproduktion. Da ist gerade ein Mann mit seinem Film im Kino, den wir da nie wirklich sehen. So Leute wie er, die im Hintergrund arbeiten und oft auch da bleiben im Hintergrund, auch wenn sie maßgeblich am Erfolg eines Films beteiligt sind. Oder könntet ihr jetzt so aus dem Stegreif sagen, wie Jeremy Latcham aussieht? Vermutlich eher nicht. Ich kann euch sagen, er sieht sehr nett aus, ist vielleicht nicht der allergrößte, so 1,70 würde ich schätzen, hat ein sehr freundliches, offenes Lachen, neugierigen Blick und was ich ja in Gesprächen immer sehr genieße, er ist sehr zugewandt. Also einer, der beim Zuhören und auch beim Reden einen anschaut, der viel weiß und viel zu erzählen hat, was kein Wunder ist. Iron Man 1 und auch 2 sind von ihm. Avengers 1 und auch 2 auch von ihm. Guardians of the Galaxy 1 dazu, der quasi ja auch wieder erste Teil, nämlich vom jüngsten Spider-Man, also Homecoming, ist auch von ihm. Und dann hat er zuletzt die beiden Filme Bad Times at the El Royale gemacht und jetzt eben Dungeons and Dragons Ehre unter Dieben, der seit Donnerstag ganz frisch im Kino ist. Und da übrigens jetzt übers erste Wochenende auch schon einigermaßen Massen reingezogen hat, gab ja auch letzte Woche von uns einen klaren Daumen nach oben dafür. Mit anderen Worten, was dieser Typ anpackt, wird irgendwie immer zu Gold und nicht selten zu einem mega erfolgreichen Franchise, das dann am Ende aus mehreren Teilen besteht. Deshalb wollte ich natürlich auch sehr gerne ihn treffen. Das haben wir gemacht. In Berlin. In dem Hotel, in dem jetzt gerade auch, ich will immer noch Prince Charles sagen. Geht euch das auch so? Ich brech mir einen ab bei King Charles. So ungewohnt. Also in dem Hotel, in dem jetzt auch gerade King Charles und seine Frau Camilla abgestiegen waren, da habe ich ihn getroffen. Kurz nachdem ich noch in Rick Cavanian reingerannt war, wir sind da fast mit den Köpfen zusammengestoßen. Er kam um die Ecke von der einen Seite, ich kam von der anderen Seite. Rick Cavanian, der in der deutschen Synchro von Dungeons and Dragons, wie immer sehr genial, hier 5 Leichen vertont hat. Sehr lustig, also falls ihr die deutsche Synchro guckt des Films oder schon gesehen habt, die 5 Leichen, die im Film auftauchen, das ist Rick Cavanian. Von dem soll ich euch schön grüßen, dann aber einen Raum weiter, Vorhang auf für ihn hier, für Mr. Goldenes Händchen bei neuen Blockbustern und der großen Frage nach der Zukunft des Kinos. Ich finde, er hat sehr eloquent versucht, sie zu beantworten.
Jeremy Latcham is with us, the producer of this beautiful movie called Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Amongst Thieves. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
I already said in the review that it's a movie that I really had lots of fun with watching in the movie theater. And I was asking myself, how important is that for you as a producer? Not only the fun I had, but that you have fun watching the movie when it's done.
Oh, I mean, that's everything, is watching the movie when it's done. And the place where I get my joy when I watch a finished film is watching with an audience. You know, we were lucky enough to take the film to South by Southwest, and we had 1,200 people in a room at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas. And we got to watch the movie with that crowd, and it was electric.
And it was not casted.
No. That is a festival. So that is 1,200 people off the street that are, the thing they all have in common, I suppose, is they're movie fans. You know, they took the time to go to a film festival, so they're probably ardent movie fans. But again, you're just with a group of people, and there they are watching the film, and they are so excited, and they're having fun, and they're laughing. And it starts to be really gratifying because you know all the conversations that have happened about a joke and about, like, oh, should we leave this joke in? Is this joke's worth it? Is this joke taking up too much time? And then you hear the audience laugh and you hear them go along with the joke and you think, okay, that joke was worth it. I'm glad we took the time. I'm glad we fought to keep that joke in. Yeah. And that's not fighting with the studio. That's just fighting with the movie. You know, the movie's trying to tell you, I want to be longer. I want to be shorter. I want to be more paced up here. I want more stakes here. Whatever it is that you're feeling as you watch the movie, and the movie's putting itself together and you're going, I think this is what we need. And then when you see it with an audience and you feel that energy, it feels like you maybe knock on wood, hopefully you got it right.
Yes, nailed it in this case. But now the more exhausting question, what if it doesn't?
Yeah, that's a terrifying question. Look, I think we are at a real disadvantage in the world that we live in right now. We are coming out against John Wick 4, Shazam 2, you know, Marvel 39, you know, it's a lot. And it's very hard to be new. And I think the thing that's interesting is, I think audiences tell us they want new. They want something new. They want a new experience. They want to meet new characters. But will they show up and do it? Remains to be seen. I know that I can take away from it. You know, I've been reading the Rick Rubin's new book, The Creative Act, is an incredible book on creativity. I think it's the best book I've ever read on creativity. And around page 250 has a chapter on success. And he says in the book, which I think is really true, the only success you can judge it by is if you're happy. Are you happy with the thing you made? Because everything else is market conditions. You know, is there a bad storm? Is there a movie similar to yours coming out? Has the culture shifted? All these questions you have no control over. He calls them market conditions, you know?
Well, and even the other people you don't have control over.
You don't have control over how people take it, how they respond to it. So the only thing you really can know as a producer is, do I like it? Have I made something I'm happy with? But who knows? I mean, it's a very crowded marketplace with a lot of sequels.
Absolutely. I see your point there. But I can't really imagine that you ever didn't have any fun with the movies that you produced. I mean, starting from Iron Man,
yeah,
then over to the Avengers, to Guardians of the Galaxy. You seem to be the kickoff man for all the huge franchises that we had.
That is a very fortunate position I've been able to be in, which I think I'm really good at making movie number one. To my heart, Iron Man 2 is not as much fun as Iron Man 1. and you know, Avengers 2, while I love Ultron, it's a tougher film than Marvel's The Avengers, which is just like bombastic and as full of love as you can get, you know?
I won't argue about that. First movies are always something else.
First movies are really special. You know, you come to it and it's anything's possible. And the further along you go, the more windows and doors close. You know, things become less possible once things start becoming real. So movie ones are, and it's great. And so we only ever looked at this as a first movie. We never thought about a sequel or planning a sequel. We only said, let's make the first movie fun.
Since Dungeons & Dragons originally was a pen and paper role play game, you had to find the right amount of fan pleasing on one hand, but also making the film work on its own on the other hand, which you did perfectly. I think you don't have to know anything about the RPG to enjoy the movie, but you always wanted to please the fans as well. How did you put that together?
So I think honestly, that's one of the places where I never grew up reading Marvel comic books. When I started at Marvel, I'd never read an actual Marvel comic book in my life. And I think that was always my secret perspective at Marvel was I didn't grow up with this stuff. I didn't grow up reading it. I lived in Venezuela and Colombia as a kid. Like I grew up overseas on oil rigs and I didn't have access to pop culture really. And so I was very unaware of any of the source material, right? Mm-hmm. But I love movies. I grew up watching movies. I did have access to movies, right? So I didn't have access to comic books, but I saw a lot of films. And so when we got here, I had never played Dungeons & Dragons. I wasn't familiar with Dungeons & Dragons. It brings this ability to have this like childlike sense of understanding of going, wait, I don't understand this as a movie. I need this to be explained more. I need this to make more sense. And so it was never like we could just put it in because, well, that's how it is in the game or that's how it is in the lore. I always have to understand, well, yeah, but how does it work for an audience? You know, how does it work for me, a person who has no, you know, awareness of this stuff? Mm-hmm. And so it's that it really ends up being a useful thing because obviously the guys are incredibly familiar with the game. Like they were incredibly familiar with Spider-Man when we worked together on Spider-Man. I was not. When we found out that Marvel Studios had never had the rights to Spider-Man. It was always at Sony. And when we found out we had the rights to Spider-Man, like, or not the rights, but we had the ability to make a Spider-Man movie, to participate in a Spider-Man movie and bring him into the MCU, I remember saying to Kevin, oh God, I have so many Spider-Man comic books to read because I've never read them before. You know, I'd been doing all my reading as we went, and I had to then all of a sudden take home 60 years of Spider-Man comics and start from scratch. But it was similar here. Like I didn't have this baggage of knowing everything. And so I was able to bring a perspective of just cinema goer, just a movie person who likes movies.
You are the famous step back.
I'm the famous step back. Exactly. And so that's always been my role. And I think that was always the role I played at Marvel. And I think that the first two phases of the MCU are very accessible to audiences.
Absolutely.
And I think it's
without knowing the comic books.
And it's become harder to be accessing it now as it goes. You have to know more about the multiverse and Kang and all this stuff. It gets more complicated. But the thing I always brought was like, we got to make this work for my grandmother. My grandmother became a famous
and the
joke.
Kids, for both.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, for people who know nothing.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
In the Marvel editing room, my Meemaw and Peepaw always became a joke. It was always like, well, what's Jeremy's Meemaw and Peepaw going to say about this? That was the ongoing joke in the editing room was we're making it for Jeremy's Meemaw and Peepaw, strangely. That was our core audience that I always imagined. And so I kept that same dumb, uninformed perspective alive here, which is like I guess the thing I have is a very dumb, uninformed perspective. And it's helpful, I think, in making movies.
Subtitle of the movie is Honor Amongst Thieves.
Yes.
Is this still only a subtitle of a movie or is this the subtitle of making movies in Hollywood?
Well, there's certainly, I think there's certainly a relatability to that phrase.
The reason why I'm asking this question about the subtitle is that we all see the air is getting thinner in cinema. There are these huge blockbusters that still run solid in the theaters if they are good. Not if they're Black Adam, they're not. But if they're good, then they run good. But where does it all go to from your perspective? Is it like blockbusters go to theaters and smaller drama and comedy and art house is what we watch at home at the streamers?
I don't think so. I think that this year, Hollywood's always in this world of like recalibrating itself and trying to figure out how best to serve the audience, you know? And I think that right now what they're realizing is people want to go back to the theater. People want to go back into the cinema and see things with people and experience things again. So I have a feeling that we're going to see more and more films starting to go theatrical first, and that some of this streaming first nonsense is going to kind of start to evaporate, and we're going to go back to the movies.
Even the smaller ones?
I think so. I mean, look, even if you look at the Academy Awards this year,
yeah,
you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once made over $100 million. And that is as small as you get of a movie. I mean, sure, it has a concept to it, and it's got a high concept to it, but that is an indie drama, you know, at its heart. And I think people wanted to go see it with their friends. They heard it was good. I think this is where it gets interesting. Mm-hmm. I think that there's not room for only okay movies at the cinema. That's the hardest part. And I think that the thing Hollywood's gotten bad at making are these mid-range blockbuster, like these mid-range movies that felt like big star things that still feel like a blockbuster. If you look back at like the 80s and 90s, you know, like Rain Man, right? It was like the third highest grossing movie of the year and it won Best Picture. That's what Hollywood's forgotten how to do a little bit, is make like a great drama that feels like a blockbuster, but it's made for $30 million and it's just two people talking. And I think we got to figure that out. You know, that's what my really strong opinion is. We have to figure out how to make a Hollywood star-driven movie that's actually good, that's worth seeing in the cinema. And so I think the hard part's become that most that's, you know, concentrated in the big movies right now. But I think that Hollywood's figuring out, yeah, people like having this experience. Let's keep making stuff. Lost City, right? Like the yeah. Channing Tatum, what's her name?
Sandra Bullock.
Sandra Bullock. Jeez Louise. That movie did very well in cinema. You know, like yeah. Those are two big glossy stars that you happen to fall in love with. So I think people like seeing those kind of movie stars in movies they can relate to. So I think that we're going to have more movies in cinema. I'm a big proponent and believer in the cinematic experience at the theater. This is the truth. Okay. I've never actually watched a whole movie that was made for streaming all the way through in one sitting at my house. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I like going to the cinema.
Yeah.
So that is clearly I like cinema movies. I make these giant blockbusters, but yeah. Like that's what I love.
So it all leads us back to quality never goes out of style.
I think that is the lesson of hopefully this era.
Absolutely hope so too. What's going to be next? When do we see part two of D&D?
You know, to talk about your interview with Kevin from a few years ago, I'm sure he also said this to you. Never plan for a sequel. Never plan, never get ahead. I think the biggest mistake, and I've seen it happen all over Hollywood, is people have this like massive 10-year plan, and they're like, before they've even made a movie, they can tell you like what the video game tie-in is going to be. And it's foolish. The thing to do is to make one good movie and to spend all your time and energy on that. It's a story that I like to tell. When I was very young at Marvel, Kevin, I said to Kevin, I have a good idea for Iron Man 2. And we were in the middle of Iron Man 1. Mm-hmm. And he said, there's no Iron Man 2. What are you doing? If you have a good idea for Iron Man 2, let's put in Iron Man 1. And I said, well, what if I don't have a good idea for Iron Man 2 when it's time to have a good idea for that? And he said, then you should quit the business. Like yeah. Your job is to have good ideas. But like, if you have a good idea, we put it in the first movie. And I think we really stuck to that ethos on this film. If we had good ideas, we had fun gags, we never talked about a second movie. We've not been planning for one. We don't have a title for one. We don't have character lineup for one. Like, we are only focusing on making something that hopefully audiences like. Yeah. And if we hear they want another movie, I think all of us would be delighted to dive in and figure that out too.
Which can even be a life lesson, even if you don't do any movies at all.
Yeah.
Just do one fucking step after the other.
Make the thing you're doing good.
Yeah.
And then hopefully if you do that, there will be success in life.
You guys can see a very good thing in theaters from now. Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves is out now. Thank you very much, Jeremy Latcham, to be at our show. Thanks for the visit.
Thank you for having me. And I hope you all enjoy the movie in the cinema where it was made to be seen.
Also, vielleicht kleines bisschen viel Englisch heute. Ich hoffe nicht zu viel mit zwei internationalen Gästen, aber ich denke, dass ihr das mit Sicherheit ziemlich gut verstanden habt. Ich meine, das ist ja auch nicht so, dass das heute jetzt noch eine großartige Fremdsprache wäre, ne? Erst recht nicht bei Menschen, die sich für Filme interessieren. Ich interessiere mich sehr für Anna Wollners Gesundheit, bin aktuell einigermaßen guter Hoffnung, dass sie ihren Rotz bis nächste Woche wieder losgeworden ist und wünsche euch bis dahin sehr selbst möglichst fit zu bleiben, keinen Quatsch zu machen, von dem es euch dann am Ende nicht gut geht und auf euch aufzupassen und bitte auf gar keinen Fall irgendwas zu gucken, was wir nicht auch gucken würden. Wäre Anna hier, ihr wisst, was sie sagen würde.
Deutschlandfunk Nova. Eine Stunde Film. Jeden Dienstag neu. Auf deutschlandfunknova.de und überall, wo es Podcasts gibt. Deine Podcasts.